welcome to episode 9 of the High Performers Platform. I'm your host, Jacob Faller, and on today's awesome episode, we have Caroline Buchanan joining us. What an awesome conversation and such a phenomenal opportunity for me to be able to sit down and not only speak to a world champion, but 8 times world champion and 2 times Aussie Olympian. So incredible conversation. Hearing how Caroline first began, stepping into BMX, progressing and persevering and pushing in a sport that was perhaps male dominant, to then, become a pioneer and create a legacy and, a foundation where females can, be creative in this space. Females can push to be professional athletes. Linking into endorsements, hearing how all of this, all of this world as a professional athlete, as an Olympian, works and the career path and how that sort of matures. Touching on some crazy highlights, hearing about Caroline's unfortunate accident. She's very lucky to be here with us today. And, just learning from one of the best female athletes in her sport. Incredible. With your intro,
let's go.
Your title is phenomenal. Titles, you've got numerous world championships, Olympic games. It's just outstanding. So perhaps you could tell us, introduce who you are and give us your whole CV. That'd be fantastic.
Okay. Well, my name is Caroline Buchanan, Aussie 2-time Olympian. Went to the London Olympics and Rio, and I'm an 8-time world champion across 2 cycling disciplines, 5 mountain bike, 4 BMX World Championships, 5 mountain bike, 3 BMX World Championships. So, 8 in total. And, I've been racing BMX since I was 5 years old, 16 national championships, Australian Cyclist of the Year, Nickelodeon Kids Choice Award. I mean, there's been quite a handful, but I've been pretty fortunate to be at the top of my game for the last 10, 15 years now.
It's such a, doing a bit of research in terms of, studying some things that I can talk about with you and actually unpacking some of that and looking at what you've achieved. It's truly phenomenal. So, first of all, congratulations and well done.
Thank you.
Second of all, how does it feel? Like when you became, world champion or the best female, BMX rider in the world, what does that feel like?
Well, when I was a little girl, BMX wasn't an Olympic sport. So that wasn't even on the radar for me. I played soccer, tennis, taekwondo, you name it. My actual decider was to either get my black belt in taekwondo at 9 years old or take my little Cabbage Patch doll to Paris to race the BMX Worlds. So at 9, I kind of made that decision that BMX was a sport that I wanted to focus on the global stage and left a lot of the other sports behind. It wasn't until I was 15 that I picked up mountain biking and added that to sort of my roster of competing in 2 disciplines at the highest level.
And just for our audience, could you clarify, the difference between BMX and mountain biking and what it is in terms of the events that you do compete in?
Yeah, so BMX, I compete in the racing discipline. So that's the Olympic category. It's basically 40 seconds. You come off like a 8-meter start hill, 8 riders on the track at once, 40 to 50 sort of kilometer speeds. That's really about that repeatable strength power efforts. And then mountain biking is completely different. I do a couple of different disciplines over there, and I do everything from slalom, which is sort of similar to like the downhill skiing, so round over the moguls and flags turns. I then do a head-to-head competition called speed and style. So it's basically your speed and then you deduct the trick off it. So it's a blend of racing and freestyle free ride. So that really is like a challenge of being quite an all-round rider. And then Crankworx is like a global sort of, I guess you could say they are the leader in the mountain bike community for like these global mountain bike events. So, they do everything from pump track to downhill to speed and style. It's basically a week of just like a festival vibe of mountain biking and everything combined. So that's one of my favorite tours. For me, it's BMX has always been the Olympic discipline. It's always been the competition. It's really been, I guess, my bread and butter, but mountain biking has been the passion. It's been like that little reset. It's helped me with longevity to like bounce between the 2 different sports and be in the city 1 week and the mountains in another week.
That's really cool. And that'll tie into, you know, some of the questions I'd love to ask is, you know, how do you stay refreshed and recharged? Most importantly was to try and work out what the difference is between the two for our audience. And, you know, as you're progressing, you mentioned 5 years old, 9 years old, progressing through, like when did you, you said nine was when you actually truly knew that this is, you know, this is what you're meant to do. This is your purpose.
Yeah, pretty young, I guess, for an athlete. Just find that. At 2 years old, my parents already knew that I was going to be some kind of athlete. We went into a movie store back then and my parents thought that, I think it was like Video Easy it was called, and they thought that I would like pick up some kind of Disney princess movie. But I got Nadia Comaneci a perfect 10 in gymnastics. It was basically a doco on her Olympic perfect score of 10. So here I am at 2 years old picking that up because I was doing gymnastics at the time and my mum's like, what does this little two-year-old want this like gymnastics doco on? Like give her a Disney princess thing. So yeah, I think my parents knew from quite that young age that they'd help steer me into sport or competition or something because I thrived on it. I would say 14 years old was a bit of a decider. So being a female in that male-dominated industry, the challenges really hit you about 14 where you question, you know, I'm not making any money out of this sport. Do I want to continue the hard yards and try to take it all the way through to the elite level? So it was really then which I made like a conscious decision. I was lucky enough to be backed by Lane Beachley with her Aim for the Stars Foundation. So a little bit of belief around me also helped molded that security with myself to kind of go, all right, I'm going to treat this as a business for the next 5 to 7 years. I'm really not going to make much income, which you've really got to do as a professional athlete. And then, you know, let those endorsements and everything flow from there.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I'd like to touch on, you know, the females in sport and the challenges and stuff. And we're privileged enough to work with quite a few professional athletes. I'm working with a couple of Matildas and, you know, hearing their stories and the battles that they've faced in perhaps a male dominant sport is, you know, it's really special for our audience. You know, we work with quite a few young females, young aspiring athletes, professional athletes. So I think it's really cool to have somebody, you know, of your caliber and professionalism on this podcast. So thank you for joining us. And, you know, if we can touch on some of that. So what challenges, you know, did you face back then and sort of how did you overcome them?
The first challenge, I think, was the fact that BMX, it wasn't surfing. It wasn't these huge mainstream sports. So it didn't have a lot of TV time. It didn't have a lot of press and coverage. And in Australia, you obviously need to be seen, to be heard, to then be wanted. So it was this like flow on effect of the sport needed to elevate for me to be able to then even exist in the world of corporate partnership. So initially it was to grow the sport to the mainstream audience of Australia. And I got a media Fox Sports so that on a Monday when, you know, the football had been on the weekend that BMX at the same time was going to be on and my results were going to be in the front of the audience. So it was a huge investment initially just to like help grow the sport. And then from there, obviously work harder on the endorsements side.
Yeah, for sure. And then speaking of endorsements, I don't know if you want to give a plug to all of your brands and things, but I've seen you on Nutrigrain. I've seen you obviously with Boost. You've got quite a lot of cool stuff happening for you.
Yeah, I think the most important thing I can say to give to any athlete is, one, being in a multidiscipline sport and doing both has helped give me the opportunity to tap into a bigger audience, to have greater support from the industry and out of industry support. But really to be your own biggest cheerleader, I got a lot of slack, I think, in the beginning when you do have to promote so hard. So I remember, you know, organizations I worked with within cycling, like, why do you have your own website? You don't need that. Like, we have your bio on our website. And it's like, you know, I'd be asking sponsors to put me in the catalogs with the boys. And they're like, no, like athletes don't sell clothes, models do. So there was a lot of like hurdles initially, but it all paid off in the end. Yeah.
So perseverance, yeah.
Perseverance. And I think part of that maybe manifesting as well, like, I never really saw it as boundaries. So when I was younger, I always saw the swimmers and they were on the front covers of cereal boxes. And I was like, one day a cycling athlete's going to be on that front cover. And this year turned around with Nutrigrain, and they asked if I want to be a part of their Unstoppable campaign, which ticked all the pillars for me. They really emphasized around coming back from my injury and hardship, and they wanted to inspire, obviously, their younger generation, which is a huge part of my inspiration too. So, yeah, strength, courage, and determination, this whole Unstoppable. Did a TV commercial and then obviously the box as well. So pretty fortunate to work with partners like Nutrigrain.
Yeah, it's massive. It's really, really cool stuff. Just touching on something you mentioned there, the support network. I think you said Lane Beachley. Did you say, yeah, originally back when you were first starting? So that support network coming through this maturation process, you know, doing the hard yards, changing the stigma perhaps around the sport, you know, being recognized, building the brand BMX itself, let alone your own personal brand. How much does that mean to you, and is that important?
Yeah, it's been a big part. For me, it's been my identity. I think also once I got through and realized that I then had the voice and the platform to be able to do what Lane did to me, that was when I started my Buchanan Next Gen Scholarship. So over the last 7 years now, 12 girls, I've helped them go from Australia and compete at the World Championships. So for me at 9 years old, I got that glimpse of the global stage. I saw all the country flags. I was in Paris racing for my country in the green and gold. And, you know, at nine, it was like, this is potentially where it's going to go in the future. So that was what I wanted to give these girls, was just that glimpse and that bit of belief and backing, which Lane did to me. So yeah, I've been really fortunate to put $76,000 into women in sport and send now 7 girls, or 12 girls over the last 7 years international to Colombia, Belgium, America, France, like you name it.
That is so special. I got goosebumps there listening to that. It's really, really awesome and rewarding. And, you know, we're opportunity-based ourselves in terms of coaching. You know, we do what we do to provide opportunities. So hearing of this type of stuff, it's just phenomenal. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, and just lead by example. Like, I was always looking up to the boys, and there wasn't too many girls. Like, I first started from this age of 5 through 12. I was actually bar to bar, elbow to elbow racing the boys. So it wasn't until I sort of got that bit older that more girls' classes started, and then we had our own, obviously, elite level racing.
Yeah, awesome. Did you mention that the race goes for 40 seconds? Did I pick up on that correct?
Anywhere from 30 is like some of our indoor tracks for BMX, through to your sort of 40 to 45 seconds. So the Tokyo course is closer to 45 if it's rainy or a headwind. But yeah, they vary from around sort of on average 400 meters is your standard course. So over 400 meters takes you about 35 seconds. Wow. And you hit about 50 kilometers at the bottom of the start hill.
Crazy. Now, I did catch some of your overspeed training, some of your acceleration work there. You're being towed on, you know, behind a motorbike. What sort of speeds are you getting up to there?
Well, we're maxed out on a Yamaha 110 in fourth gear. So probably about 60 kilometers. That's really working on that top end max high cadence. I like to keep my training fun. I've definitely always been like that athlete that I want to show up and shine, but I don't want to be like changing my gears and overcomplicating it and bringing out my data and bringing out this measurement and whatever. So I like to maximize what I can by, if I'm doing overspeed training and I don't have to change my gearing or find a hill and I can just get simply towed in by a motorbike, I'm getting the same outcome with less headache and I can get the job done, get out. So yeah, basically being a full-time athlete from the time I left school to now being 30 years old, I've realized what works, not areas to obviously cheat, but areas to get the same outcome, obviously a bit smoother.
Training smarter, not harder. We always train harder. You're a professional athlete. I've seen some of your sessions that you post and stuff. Crazy in terms of work ethic, and train smarter, not harder. That's the key for long term, isn't it?
Yes.
And making it fun as well. If it was tedious and boring, who knows what we'd be doing?
Yeah, exactly. So if anyone wants to look, my social media is at CBuchanan68, or you can just search Carolyn Buchanan. I keep it pretty fun, everything from, you see the raw gains faces of deadlifting 140 kilos through to my overspeed chaining through to my backyard air jump. Kind of just put it all up on there for everyone to see.
Yeah, it's really cool. And again, super inspiring. So the female population in sport and athletes in sport, you know, seeing a role model like you working hard, actually lifting weights, I think that's the best thing that I've noticed is you train, you know, correctly and properly. Obviously, you're a professional athlete and Olympian, but lifting weights, strength training, power training, you know, it's all done properly. And as a performance coach, it makes you really happy. So
yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I've actually just switched up my program. So when I was 9 years old, I stepped foot in my first gym. I wanted to train. I wanted to be in that environment so young. So my dad actually paid for like a local PT, and it was super basic, from your core to your proprioception to just learning how to balance on one knee to basic hopping, squatting onto a box. So yeah, from that age through to then the ACT Academy of Sport quite early as well, I really wanted to be in that training environment. Again, I was too young. So my dad was just like, get this girl in, like, she's hungry, I'm going to back her. And yeah, so initially we had to invest into being into ACTAS. And then a few years later, I actually got on scholarship, which was the draft into the Australian Institute of Sport, the AISC in Canberra. And then obviously based overseas, I had to be super accountable through all the visual coaching programs and doing it from distance over 10 years to now being back in Australia, back in Canberra. And I've actually mixed it up over the last 6 months with a new powerlifting coach, Grant Haynes. So he's made a world of difference. My technique was always good. Like, it wasn't dangerous. I never had any injuries. But he's just been able to elevate it to that next level and look at me from a different perspective and a new eye. And it's been the most refreshing break over this COVID. And, you know, he's elevated my goals of going, like, you know, I think by Christmas we have 150 kilo squat, a 50 snatch, and an 85 clean is our goals. So I'm chipping away at almost being there at the moment.
That is strong. Yeah, that's 150 kilo squat.
Yeah.
Awesome. And what was the snatch, sorry?
At 66 kilos body weight. Wow. Yeah. 50 snatch is the goal.
Fantastic.
Yes. That's so currently power to weight on the bike, I'm putting out 20 watts per kilo, which we measure that on a watt bike and a 3 second sprint. So yeah, getting up to these are pushing on the best numbers I've pushed in my career so far. I had 2 years out of the sport, so I'm now at a point where the sport's elevated in 2 years. I'm now stepping into new territory for my own of where I've never been. So it's fun. The hard yards were definitely done over the last 2 years to get my body back to being able to push these numbers.
I'd like to touch on that since you've just brought it up. It might be a perfect opportunity if you're happy to share with us. So was it 2017, Caroline, you had the car accident, is that correct?
Yes, a New Year's Eve of 2017.
Do you mind telling, you know, myself and our audience that story, and we'll get to the rehab side of things. But initially, what yeah. did happen? You know, it was such a
big thing. So very fortunate, obviously, to be alive. I had an off-road vehicle accident with a friend. So I was on a private property. Buggy rolled down a fire road. I ended up underneath it. So the combination of I was very fortunate, rolled back onto four wheels. It didn't stay on top of me and pinch me. So as I went under and grabbed the roll cage, basically with in a bench press position right across my sternum, it went slow-mo. I just kept telling myself, like, don't get pinched, because I could feel the weight pushing through my chest. And so it was in that bench position, pushed as much weight as I could. Luckily, yeah, it went onto four wheels and I got up and I knew instantly, like, I didn't know what I'd done, but the feeling was I was winded and never attained like that breath. So I stayed in that winded state for the next like 4 hours until I had lung drains and everything in Canberra Hospital. The process from this private property through to Cooma Hospital, then the transfer from Cooma through to Canberra was about 4 hours. When I got to Canberra Hospital, that was when they basically, yeah, did all my scans and said, you've punctured your heart wall lining, you've double punched and collapsed both lungs, so pneumothorax both, and then you've broken your sternum as well as broken your nose. So went into ICU for 10 days from that point, and initially it was all around just healing. It was getting the blood and everything out of my body, so all of the drains. And then by that point, the next one was like, I'm already asking the doctors, like, when can I ride again? What are we looking like? And they sort of said, well, you're looking down the path of like the next 6 months purely from your sternum. If it heals naturally, we'll look at the next, you know, goalpost of surgery if we have to get to that point. So that was, in a nutshell, the start of my rehab process, and the complications followed from there, which took 2 years for me to go through three sternum reconstructions, complications with it not calcifying, not healing, snapping a titanium plate, bolts backing out, you name it. So, yeah, the third and final surgery finally fixated my chest, and I was able to return to sport. And the whole process was about 2.5 years.
Wow. That is, you know, I can only, we can read about it, you know, for us on the other side, we can read, you know, snippets in the news and Wikipedia and research on you, Caroline, but that is so big, yeah? And like you said, such a devastating injury and thing to happen that you are really lucky to be alive from something like that. Crazy. Two and a half years of complications, rehabilitation, you know, rebuilding yourself. Were you training in that time, or was it 2.5 years off and just really being conservative and working on what you need to work on?
It was really limited. It wasn't an injury, you know, like knees or ACLs where you can start moving them, you can start rehabbing them and you want to move. It was the opposite. It was to fixate that bone, you're already breathing. So your rib cage is already expanding. There's already movement, which complicates the process. You can't throw a cast on it and have no movement. So that complicated. So it was really controlling my breathing, controlling my lifestyle, really not doing anything to exert myself. And I was in like a T-Rex position for months. So the rules were basically the first initial 2 months was couldn't drive, couldn't have anything that potentially impact my chest. Don't lift your arms above your head. So, you know, don't reach for plates in the kitchen. Don't lift anything more than, you know, pouring your cup of tea or like your plate and fork. So couldn't even hold like a 2 kilo thing of milk. Became quite complicated, not being able to go to your grocery store, push doors open, wash your hair. Like, so super fragile was just like the best way I could explain how I had to baby that injury, waiting for just this like bone in your body, which barely gets any amount of blood, to calcify and the cartilage to layer and wrap around all this new metal and hardware. And when I first got cleared from the first sternum surgery, I was returned to the sport. The biggest lesson I made from that was I didn't have a rescan. So I wasn't advised to get another CT or MRI. Which I recommend everyone, if you've ever had an injury, get a follow-up rescan to make sure you actually are healed, because I'd followed the guidelines, but for me, my body wasn't calcifying properly. I was low in vitamin D, so my calcium couldn't do its job, and I didn't know that at the time, so I wasn't ready to return to sport, and that was when I snapped the titanium plate, and that was when we went back in for the second surgery.
It's such a, and look, I've never had an experience with this type of injury, but we look at bones, like bones are so super tricky compared to obviously the musculoskeletal system and ligaments and tendons. And it is that calcification, the healing process. And I think you've just highlighted a really important point for most athletes. If you have a severe injury, you know, whatever scale of the spectrum, get a second opinion, like get a second scan. Actually see what's happening before you do just go ahead. Even if you're following the guidelines, even if it is with a sports doc and a professional, I mean, they should be recommending you get one. But please do, because you don't know unless you know, yeah? You've got to be able to see what's happening. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Second, third opinions. I mean, I definitely, by the end of it, was seeking 2, 3, 4 opinions for the actions that I was taking, getting follow-up bloods, like, checking everything that was going on in my body, because I was a bit naive in the beginning and didn't know. So by the end, it was waking up every morning, you know, getting my circadian rhythm in check, watching the sunrise physically, watching the sunset, grounding, like getting in enough vitamin D, just laying out in the sun, like all odd things which you'd think wouldn't help, but part of just letting nature heal nature and let your body adapt.
coming out of your rehabilitation, you know, after your last operation and you're returning to sport, what then comes next for you?
Well, when I returned to sport, I was on a crunch line. I knew that I basically had to try qualify for the Tokyo Olympic Games within a 4-month window. And I only had about 2 months to really rebuild before I could get back on the bike. So for me, it was first of all focusing on just like posteriorly, like could I get my body in the right posture to have correct movement? That was number one. And then from there, it was a big part about my mind. It was knowing that I wasn't fragile and breakable. So I actually started boxing Muay Thai. So I worked with a trainer in the US, and part of it was getting out that aggression of, you know, all these complications and not being able to work out, not being able to have that outlet. So yeah, it was a combination of the mind, but also knowing like I can take a hit, I can take a fall, I can take a crash. And then started really building back my base strength and conditioning as quick as I could. I knew the numbers which I'd gotten in my career before, but I knew it was going to take a lot of time to lay that proper foundation. So for me, it was really a silver lining. COVID hit and it was like I can actually have a bit more of a breather to go back, and I put in 4 solid strength blocks of 6-week programs. And that was really what I needed, just to grind through and get my numbers back to where they needed to be.
Yeah, cool. Can we touch on, and if you'd like to share, can we touch on some of your trainings? You know, I know I understand some of what I think you'd be doing, but if you can share with me, I'd love to learn, and obviously our audience as well.
Yes. Yeah, so for me, I'm training coming into these next Olympics as if the Olympics is going to be on. We're not 100% sure if it'll be cancelled or not, but at this stage it's on, so you act as if it's going to be on. My training program at the moment consists of 2 strength power gym days a week. And then I have a conditioning gym day in there as well as like my 3rd program. Majority of my gym program is all Olympic lifts. It's really about obviously just maximizing that power. So yeah, now my program is more your front squats, back squats, deadlifts, snatches, power cleans, and then the accessory core and movement. And then I have my bike days. So every Wednesday I go to the track, practice skills and starts. Fridays is like a local race. I've started tapping into a few more races each week within New South Wales, just to go back to clubs I haven't been to in like the last 11 years, heading up to Brisbane in a few weeks to tap into some racing up there. So trying to maximize as much racing without being on that global tour. And then my high speed sprints, which we just talked about behind the motorbike, that max cadence. And then I test my power on a watt bike. So my fan 1, fan 10 max effort on a watt bike, and my repeatable sessions are on a watt bike as well.
Awesome. And for me, again, performance coach base, listening to high caliber athletes and, you know, the specificity of what you're doing. And it's the, you know, it's maximizing each session. It's not overtraining. It's being very calculated. So it's, yeah, it's really awesome to hear. Super cool.
And keeping it fun, mixing in the mountain biking. And I've got the airbag in my backyard. So last night was backflips and 360s and all those tricks. So it's also like playing into taking some hits there and some scorpions and waking up and jumping to gym the next day. And so I manage my recovery as well with like an infrared sauna, which I do every other day here, as well as chiropractic. My chiropractor is also a neuro, so I've had many concussions over the years in the world that I live in. So he helps manage the concussions that I've had and the anesthesias that I've had, as well as, yeah, the neuro side. And then I also get dry needling and massage every other week as well.
Really cool. Anything to keep you, you know, highly performing and down regulate? Absolutely. Do you do any breath work? I spoke to John about this, and we look at breath work techniques, breathing, meditation.
I was fortunate enough, I did like a Tai Chi class within a Buddhist meditation retreat that was actually based in Wollongong 6 years or so now. I wanted to work just tapping into controlling my breath for the start. So it was very specific into controlling my emotions for those couple of seconds. I was always late. I was always becoming overwhelmed and I'd always miss time in the gate. So that meditation retreat with a bit of Tai Chi really helped then. I extended it after my injuries. I actually did a 7-day, 90% noble silent meditation Buddhist retreat in California. And that was like one of the most challenging things I've ever done. You know, you'd sit down for like the Buddha monks would come in and the brothers and sisters, and like you'd do sitting meditation with a gong at like 5:15 in the morning. And then you'd be like working on like the property and you'd be like doing sweeping meditations, and it's like in, out, in, out. So it was crazy to go through that extremity and then to pull back obviously to sport and just life and healing. So for me, I've used breath work for my gait specifically to set my core properly and be able to get that maximum amount of power when that random light goes. And then sort of just post as well. So we only have 20 minutes between we go up for the next round. So recovery is really important for that. So I sort of focus on those recovery breaths of in what's worked for me. There's so many different techniques, but I always go nose, 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 mouth, nose, 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 mouth, like opposite for at least the first like conscious 6 breaths when I finish racing, finish a lift, you know, a heavy sort of max out in the gym or something like that. The reason that I like sort of the jumping between the nose and the mouth is because you have to physically think about it. So it brings you back to the moment, makes you mindful, and makes you conscious of those first sort of initial recovery breaths.
That's really cool. Thank you for sharing that, because breath work, although there's, you know, so many different types of techniques, it's still a very, very individualized thing. You know, a lot of people gravitate towards one particular style, or this doesn't work for someone, but this doesn't. So if you're playing around and, you know, creating your own custom method and what works for you, and I love that, yes, it's breath work, but it's also that mindfulness. So you are concentrating on what you're doing and taking all the external away from everything. That's super cool. I'm going to give it a go. In terms of skills, so obviously it's a highly skilled sport. We look at 40 seconds of competing, but that's a max out effort. That's the, you know, the pinnacle of years of training and a lifetime of training. In those 40 seconds thereabouts of this competition, you know, whether it be the Olympics or you know, the world titles, whatever it might be, what's actually involved? So I've got the start gate and the timing and your reaction. Can you walk us through the actual race, please? I think that'd be really cool.
Yeah, so from the start gate, there's no white lines, so you want to get out in front and out of trouble from your 7 other competitors. Majority of the time, whoever has won to the bottom of the hill generally wins the race. If you win to the first turn, they call it the whole shot. Normally the front 3 don't really change from the training, and skills goes into the gate start. The first initial 4 pedals to get to the halfway point on the hill, and then obviously just your acceleration and that sort of to get to high velocity by the first turn. So from the start gate, obviously a bit of balance is involved. The biomechanics behind it is your legs are only as strong as your weakest link. So you can do as much leg work as you want, but if you can't hold onto the handlebar and transfer that through your body motion, you're not going to be efficient. So much of the work we do is efficiency based, and making sure that we're quite equal between the top of our body and the bottom of our body and transferring. Once you are basically into your high speed velocity, it's more about that hip stability and holding position so that you get a really good visual of the tracks. So a lot of neck strength we do as well, especially after crashes or after concussions, bringing that neck strength in to hold our helmets helps with, you know, your vision on the track and that ability to maintain eyesight of where you want to go, for your legs to obviously fire off that high cadence. So hip stability is a big part of it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's really interesting, you know, the line of sight and where you're looking. I presume where you look is where you go, is that correct?
Yeah, or mountain biking, you look at the tree, you'll hit the tree.
Very good. That's a very important message to share, isn't it? Where you look is where you go. Fantastic. Thanks so much for sharing, because it is fascinating. We do, you know, we watch it on TV, and we understand what we see, but everything that goes into that, you know, each turn or the gates, there's so much in, you know, what's happening.
Yeah, 45 seconds, it's all over. It's not a sport that I would like place bets on, because it is quite unpredictable. A lot of crashes always happen, but that's what makes that champagne taste so much sweeter, when you do piece it all together, and from the start of the day of qualifying through your rounds, quarters, semis, finals, and when you've backed up 7 perfect laps in a day and you come away with the win, like, that's what you're striving for.
That's you and your element. That's fantastic. Can we talk? We're talking about sweet champagne here. Can we talk about the Olympic Games and phenomenal achievement? You know, what does it feel like, Caroline? Can you share with us?
Yeah, well, for me, my first Olympics was London. I was too young for the Beijing Olympics. For BMX, they had an age cutoff of 18. So for me, I had to wait that extra 4 years to come into the London Olympics. It was really surreal. I found, for me, I was really consumed by this just like yellow brick road, like eat, sleep, breathe, this medal, all my worth is on this medal, all my everything. I'm not enough if I don't get this medal. So I found that was like a bit of a letdown by the time I actually got to the Olympic Games as the world champion, had won the time trial, won the rounds, won the quarterfinal, won the semifinal. Had first lane pick, which is what you want coming into the final. I was like, I've almost ticked every box. I'm exactly where I need to be. And then it was like meltdown. Then I remember I chose the local hometown favorite who'd carried the flag for the British team. You know, she was on Visa commercials and Red Bull and all this. So like the hype of the games brought this added element to the competitors. And that really, like, in my mind, raised her like bigger than life. So even though I'd won all day, I still had this vision that she was this bigger athlete than me. And I was like, well, I don't want her to, you know, affect my Olympic Games. I started playing defensively, and that mindset of stepping away from the sport and going, oh, well, I'll go lane 3 and let her have lane 1. And then we won't come together. We won't tangle each other, and she won't affect me. So that derailed. So that defense, going from that basically mindset all, you know, years coming into the Olympic Games of preparation, where you're playing to win, you're putting your best foot forward, you're putting all this emphasis onto the steps and the process, and you're fully invested, to then worrying about, this is my race to lose. It stopped right there. So the performer walked out the window, the fear set in, and I missed the start. David Beckham staring back at me. I remember him on the big screen and the royal family, and like, the Olympics is just gnarly. So then I missed the start, was in 5th coming around that last turn and crossed the line with the medals in front of me, and just thought to myself, like, that was all on me and no one else. And that was a real hard pill to swallow, definitely.
Yeah, wow. Thank you so much for sharing. That is so huge. You know, David Beckham looking back at you, Olympic Games.
Who else wouldn't melt?
The perfect picture, but then to get in and flip, you know, that fear sets in, and then to change everything, you know, it's unfortunately we're all human beings, and our default mechanism is that fear, you know, until we've either experienced it, until you've overcome it, until you've, you know, had that experience you did. Can you talk to us about then, so that's happened, you've learned these skills, you've learned, you know, the experience that not many people ever get to experience in this lifetime. Rio, in terms of your next Olympics, can you talk to us about that?
So the following year after the London Olympics, I guess I had something to prove to myself, and I just wanted to make sure that I wouldn't make that same mistake again, that I was prepared, that I was getting the max out of my body, knowing what can I achieve? Like, I'm really limiting myself here. And I knew that I'd played defensively then. I didn't want to anymore. So I set a goal to actually win 3 world titles on 3 different bikes, 2 different disciplines, 76 days, 3 countries, 3 energy systems. So I was like, if I can manage this, I can manage one day at the Olympic Games. That was my goal. I calculated that year I spent 2 weeks in an aircraft straight, the amount of miles I did. I won the first BMX world title the following year after that Olympics, indoor arena in New Zealand, then flew to Europe, jumped on my mountain bike, won the four cross world championships, which was in Austria. So that's more of similar to snowboard cross. So it's four people on a mountain bike down a course, jumps, moguls, head to head. So won that world title and then went to Peter Maritzburg in South Africa, and then tapped into downhill. So that was a 4.5 minute all out basic sprint downhill, as quick as you can go. So then that was tapping into another energy system. And that one I ended up placing fifth. So I walked away from that experience with obviously the medals and the accolades and all of this like praise from Australian sport and two world titles in 1 year and all of that. But I had that just sense of relief of going like, that's what I can achieve in a different mindset to worried about losing. And that was the flow-on effect into Rio and into like not repeating the same process. Unfortunately, Rio, even though I was in a much better mindset, again, was the world champion coming in. I'd struggled visually with the track. So the track was red and green. They painted it for the games. And I naturally already have one good eye and wear a contact in the other. I'd had a concussion 3 weeks out. I struggled visually just to see this track and feel sharp. So I was already a little bit hesitant, but semi-final, I got boxed in between two Russians. They squeezed me at the bottom of the hill. Nose case, the first jump, bars moved, jackknife crashed into the first turn. So I didn't even make the final. I was devastated, was in tears, went up into the crowd. It was probably 10,000 just screaming South African Colombian fans, one of my biggest and best rivals. We've always had like healthy relationship in sport. The Colombian, she'd won the two Olympic Games. I got a standing ovation from 10,000 Colombians that I'm there in tears with the Aussie flag around my neck. I just crashed out in the semi and I'm up in the stands with the Aussies about to watch the Olympic final that I couldn't compete in. So that was for me that power of sport, that Olympic moment to go win or lose. That comes back to Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the Olympics, of, you know, to be that solid competitor and to have that healthy respect. And whether I won the final or whether I crashed out, to get such a similar ovation, I was like, this is my Olympic moment. Cool. So yeah, that was probably the highlight of any Olympic Games, was just standing there in tears to that wall.
I'm just sitting here trying to envision and feel, you know, I could never ever replicate something like that. 10,000 people, you know, it's phenomenal. You should be so super proud of yourself. It's incredible. Awesome. Can we talk about, you know, the biggest question I'd like to ask you is, what does riding actually mean to you?
Just passion. It's like passion, it's purpose. What's like, what makes me tick? I think any sport I would have been drawn to, naturally sport just brings out that competitor. Individual sports, like when success is on you and failure is on you, that was what I found real early. I was like, in soccer, I wanted to kick the goal and I wanted to like save the goal. And I was like, this isn't going to work for me. Like I need sports, which it does all come back down onto you. And like, I love that pressure as an athlete. So, yeah. And then having 2 years out from the sport, I realized like the simplicity of that little 5-year-old girl that fell in love with riding bikes, some piles of dirt and two wheels at the end of the day. Like I've rode a kid's bike for a living. And I'm pretty proud of that. So yeah, that's what it really comes down to. Some piles of dirt and just playing on your bike.
That's really cool. And look, I noticed for Book Week a couple of weeks ago, you had some lovely young girls dressed up as you go into Book Week. Like that's so cool to see. Can you talk to us on that?
Oh, that's adorable. Yeah. When I was injured out, I wanted obviously like something to keep my mind occupied. So did two kids' books, helped was the author of that and published it with actually Tia Claire Toomey's publisher, who she did a book with. So yeah, we published it together, and it was all around girls can be brave and girls can be different. So they're real stories from when I was a little girl at that target market of 6 to 8 year old. One was dress up day. So I dressed up as a BMX bandit at school and remembered struggling to embrace my identity. Was like, oh, I should just go for the safe route, should be a doctor or a princess or something. So yeah, it was all about standing up and, you know, being proud with my little BMX trophy and my outfit at school, and to embrace that uniqueness. And then I did Girls Can Be Brave, and that was about my secret jump that I've been planning. And a true story again, my dad, I wanted to jump this double, they call it, so it's got a gap in the middle, so it's a little bit more intimidating, and he made it a tabletop, so he actually put a door across the jump and taught me to jump it with this like little safety pad of the door. So yeah, it was around that, this secret jump I'd been planning, and the execution of it.
What do you do, Caroline, in terms of, you're 99% of the time a professional athlete. Outside of being an athlete, you know, what do you do? What do you like to do?
Well, I'm fortunate since COVID too, being back in Australia. As I said, like, I lived in California for 10 years. I love French Bulldogs. Like, they're obviously like a huge passion of mine. So I'd love that to be future business. But yeah, we live on 600 acres on my boyfriend John Pruddy's property. So there's cows and sheep and dogs and chickens. I've obviously got like my backyard training set up. He's always coaching motorbikes. So there's always things happening. So whenever I'm not training, I'm either helping him with his photo shoots or videography business, or, you know, there's kids rocking up to do coaching. So yeah, I keep definitely busy all around. Yeah, cool. I like to have that downtime and that switch off with girly TV, Kardashians, just polar opposite to being that adrenaline sport athlete.
Yeah, really cool. And just, yeah, taking note of some of the stuff, like that sort of free play where you're doing those backflips you described before onto the pillow. Like, that's, for us, that's insane. For you, you're just having some fun, yeah?
Yeah, having some fun and just keeping that challenge. Like, it's so good as an athlete to be scared and to remain, like, sharp and to have that healthy respect with, obviously, well, that healthy respect with, like, risk-reward. And for me, that's one thing that element gives me. It's that feeling of knowing that I'm alive, that I'm going in for that challenge, and your body's giving you all these fear responses, but you accept it and you override it and, you know, you execute. So I love that just balance that the sport throws at you. Some days I want to cry, sometimes I have meltdowns, but majority of the time I walk away like, woo.
Pumped. With that much adrenaline in the body, it'd be hard not to.
Yeah.
Any tips? So for any young aspiring athlete, you know, any young female athlete or female in general, Caroline, what's some messages that, you know, you've either unlocked along the way or some things you'd like to share?
Well, I think the multi-athlete, I think that's a huge one. Other athletes I've known, even in athletics, that, you know, they've either just wanted to be that javelin athlete, but they've decided, oh, they can do javelin, but they're also a really good sprinter, or anyone that I think has those opportunities, it's going to help with the longevity. It's going to help you as an athlete all around. So it's been a huge skill set and asset to not only my physical career on the bike, but also my brand. So I can't stress that enough, that if you've got opportunities to do one sport or both, it's like Elise Perry, she obviously was in soccer and then did cricket as well, and she's such a household name. You can do it, and, you know, it's been shown. And then we spoke about, obviously, with like the doctor side of it, to be your own doctor, but also to seek second, third opinions for everything at every step along the way, so that you can make smart choices and proper assessments, and then you won't have as many complications. So definitely that's a big tick. And then I just say, following up, now that with sport, it's such a big part to be just as much of an athlete off the field as it is to be on, and to make money and to make a living out of it, to be, you know, a really good brand ambassador for not only sport, your sponsors. It's all about authenticity, about that consistency, and about taking that unique path, about being super different and finding that niche angle. That's what my team really helped me discover. We're all on this learning journey, and they're like, you know what, your audience is 80% 25 to 30 year old males. let's approach brands that are working in that and they want to target that. So I would have never thought that Harley Davidson and these, like, you know, ironically, like, tatted up male brand kind of things, but you can work into that, and there's so many ways that you can, you know, embrace that uniqueness to obviously create your future and your outcomes. So from a brand side, from the sports side, and from, you know, the doctor side of it, those would be my biggest takeaways.
Yeah, awesome. I think it's really great that you're sharing the message of, you know, not just trying to specialize or early specialization as such just in your one field. Like, it might be your sole purpose and your passion, but doing other things, like, you accumulate such a wealth of experience, but also skill set. You know, you talked about taekwondo and soccer and all of these things that you've done and tried, and you know, that builds. It's like the snowball effect. Obviously, if you're going to specialize and get to the Olympic Games, it's a lifetime, you know, it's a life mission. That's your massive dream. So yeah, doing the small steps, building, doing different things, accumulating skills, and pushing hard. Yeah, I agree. Very good.
And I think it's been proven to everyone, you can't really judge what's going to go on in the world. And even right now, to sit back as an athlete and go, if the Olympic Games isn't on and this is the end for so many athletes, what's next? What's around the corner? What's another option? So yeah, fortunate to have mountain biking and have these other avenues if things like that do happen.
Is it deflating to know that, you know, if the Olympic Games wasn't to happen and you spent all this time, 4 years preparing, is it deflating, or is it because you're staying accountable and chipping away that it's not too detrimental?
Yeah, got to stay accountable and just keep motivating, as I said, act as if. I always like to look at the podium. It's probably my little superstitious thing. When I'm at an event, I always like to look at that podium and picture myself on it before I've even stepped foot into the arena. It's the same thing right now. You have to act as if the Olympics are on. You have to act as if you're going to be there and step backwards to know, what do I need to do to stay accountable every single day? So I have my vision board, which has my weekly training layout Monday through Sunday. Then I have my content plan of what I'm doing with brand endorsements, so that doesn't conflict. Then I obviously have my slay five, which is my five things to just slay the week, have to get done. And then obviously, like, my goals as well, which are everything from BMX to mountain bike to life to goals to family to balance. So I have, like, my full vision board, which keeps me accountable every single day as well.
Super cool. For anyone who doesn't have a vision board, hopefully after listening, you know, to this podcast, you're going to get one, and start one. Could not recommend more. And, you know, it's such a phenomenal thing to do, because from your experience, it sounds like your vision board has come to fruition in all formats. But even for myself, you know, I built a vision board maybe almost 7 years ago, and I put my 5-year plan up and had pictures, and some of the pictures didn't make sense just yet, and I wasn't sure as to how that would look like at the end destination. But I'm sitting here having a conversation with you today, and, you know, I'm at the end of my 5-year plan. My gym is my dream facility. You know, all of these things happen, and it's such a positive thing and such a strong thing to do. You know, the affirmations and, you know, reflecting daily, and yeah, just picturing yourself being there.
Yeah, and throw those motivational words up there. I've obviously, I've been watching more Netflix than ever through this time, and just watching sport. So the F1 series, and there's, like, the playbook with the coaches, and I've been so motivated picking up things from those series. So yeah, I've got on there at the moment, like, delayed, not denied. Like, that's a real key for me right now with this pause and this break in the Olympics. So it's like, you know, I look at that and it's like, what's delayed is not denied, you know, just keep going. There was, like, another one through that Netflix series, and it was just said, one of the coaches was like, hold fast, stay true. And it just meant, you know, hold fast like to your goals, but stay true in the direction of, like, true north, true south, true
stay
east.
The course.
And just, like, keep going and keep charging. Yep. So yeah, those little things too added to the vision board. But you've also got to be ready to wipe that board. You know, that first little break of COVID, I thought would only be 3-4 months, and then moving back to Australia and all this other stuff. So it's like, be prepared to wipe it, add more, just keep challenging yourself and keep going.
That's the art of leveling up, isn't it? You can't set the what am I looking for the word here? The spectrum or the limit, too shallow. You got to put some things up there that are quite bold, the unachievables, because you never know how far you can go unless you try.
Definitely.
Such gratitude to be able to sit here and, you know, firstly meet, let alone discuss and hear, you know, a phenomenal athlete and a world icon in her sport. Thank you, Caroline, for your time. I really appreciate it. It's a fantastic conversation. I hope all of our audience enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. And once again, this podcast has been brought to you by The Unknown, the barbershop in Preston and Oakley, and Oxidate Performance. Thanks again for listening. We appreciate all of our listeners and subscribers. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do share it. Give it a like, give it a review on Apple Podcasts. You know, the more traction we build, the greater and better we can be. Thanks again. I'm your host, Jacob Fallon. Looking forward to rolling out a couple more episodes and, you know, changing the pace a little bit as well. Next week's episode is a massive one. We actually have a bronze medalist from the Paralympics in Rio. And this is a phenomenal conversation. We dive deep into some really, really extraordinary areas, things that, you know, will blow your mind and things that have me, you know, really, really fascinated and, you know, deep in discussion. Looking forward to it. Thanks again.